The year is 2074. Climate change is wiping out entire nations, and corporations are profiting from those who survive. This is the terrifying future presented in Daughter of Bad Times, a new novel by the Australian author Rowan Wilson. Rowan's previous books have been set in the past, so I wonder what inspired this leap into a not-so-distant future. Rowan Wilson, welcome.
Good morning, Claire.
So this book covers climate change and refugee policy. Had you decided from the outset, Rowan, that you wanted to write an overtly political novel?
In a way, I did. I think when I started looking at the evidence that was laid out, I was reading things like the IPCC climate change report, looking at data projections, looking at demographic projections, and it did start to make me feel a little pessimistic. I'm not normally a pessimistic person. I'm by nature fairly optimistic, and I think there are definitely solutions to the problems we're looking at, but it did leave me feeling just a little bit concerned. So when I started to write, I think that concern probably shows itself in the book. It is a little grim at times, but it is also ultimately pretty hopeful. You know, there's a love story at the centre of the book, and I think the message I was trying to give, if there's such a thing in a book as a message, I think I was trying to say something about the power of love to help us in these needful times.
Thank you for that love story. It did help me through the pretty terrifying future that you paint. On this idea of political writing, there'll be some authors that will tell you that all writing is political. What's your take on that idea?
Certainly, completely agree. It's either overtly political, and I guess my writing is fairly political. But if you're not discussing those ideas, then you're upholding the status quo. You're saying that the things are good enough right now. And I don't know. When you look forward, certainly when you look at climate change, it's a little difficult to say that things are okay right now. I think there does need to be a little bit of change going on. We need to start taking it a bit more seriously and trying to certainly to at least try and save countries like the Maldives, if nothing else. You know, that seems to me that a little crazy that we'd let them drown.
So talk to me about the Maldives, because this is a location in your book. Your man lives there and his home is destroyed. What happens to the Maldives in your book?
Well, the Maldives, as people will know, is only around 2 metres above sea level, or mostly less than that. The highest point is around 2 metres. It's an archipelago nation, or islands made of sand for the most part. And as sea level rises, they are existentially threatened. The water table on most of the islands can become polluted by salt water, which makes them uninhabitable. So they're slowly losing territory, even today, with only 20 or 25 centimetres of sea level rise. You know, 50 or 100 years from now, when we've had a metre or a metre and a half of sea level rise, the entire country may well drown. So that's the future that I'm charting out in the novel. And the government of the Maldives is very aware of this. They've been spending a lot of time thinking about contingency plans. They've wondered whether they might have to sort of airlift the population out at some stage. They've built artificial islands next to the capital island as a sort of a backup. You know, if they lose the capital, they're hopeful they can move everyone over to this artificial island to buy themselves a few more years. And, you know, it's a serious, serious problem for them that worries them deeply every day. And it does make us, well, it made me personally sort of stop and think, like, as an Australian, you know, and I live in Brisbane. I live on a fifth floor in an apartment building. Climate change doesn't affect me too much personally. I'm not going to drown. You know, my country's probably not going to vanish the way that the Maldivians face that threat. And it started to sort of pose a bit of an ethical problem for me as well. I felt a little wrong to not face this and not deal with it as a writer.
Dealing with it as a writer is really interesting, because you're exploring this idea, and as readers, we get to consider this idea. Do you think that by the act of writing this book, you can make a change, you can actually inspire change out there in the real world, Rowan?
I'd like to think so. I really would. It's a difficult question to answer, isn't it? All of the stuff we put out into the world has an impact on people. And I've spoken to people who've read my other books, and you know, people have told me that especially a book like The Roving Party, which is about the Tasmanian Aboriginal genocide. You know, a lot of people I've spoken to said they had no idea that that had gone on and that it had been so bloody on the frontier in Tasmania. So I know that in some ways my fiction does impact people and it does change the way they think. So I'm conscious of that. And I would hate to think that my books are just entertainment. You know, I would like to think that they also make people reflect. And I think all good fiction ultimately does that, doesn't it? It makes us question who we are and what we believe. So hopefully mine does the same thing.
Yeah, I guess it can teach us too things that we might not know or understand. So we were talking about Yaman, the hero of this book. His home in the Maldives is destroyed by a tsunami. He becomes a client of KB Yasuda Corrections. What does this company do with climate change refugees, Rowan?
KB Yasuda Corrections are a multinational corrections company. They run for-profit prisons and for-profit immigration detention centres. And companies like this exist in the world right now, and they're quite big, and they exist in Australia and they exist in the US. And if you're a prisoner in the US, you might be put into a prison that's run by a for-profit company, and you'll be put to work, and you'll be paid at a very, very low rate, you know, a dollar a day or less for the work you do. So you're effectively a slave that is owned by this corporation for the duration of your sentence. Or if you're in immigration detention, then you don't have a sentence. You haven't actually done anything wrong. You're being imprisoned for political reasons, more or less. So in my book, Daughter of Bad Times, we find these climate refugees, people from the Maldives, a country that's now gone. They end up in Sri Lanka, and from Sri Lanka they're brought to Australia by KB Yasuda and put into various facilities around Australia, which are labelled as migrant training centres, which is a little bit cynical. Effectively what they are is manufactories. Imagine a big company like Foxconn in China that builds electronics. They're like a manufacturer that builds electronics. The detainees live there, they sleep, they eat, their whole lives are contained in this big facility. And they're working more or less to pay off their debt to the Australian government, the debt that's owed now for the costs of bringing them to Australia, the cost of their visa, the cost of their insurance, the cost of their health coverage, all of that. So they're expected now to pay that back to the Australian government by working for KB Yasuda Corrections. So it's a bit of a grim system. But
and what's most upsetting is every time they use a bar of soap or have something to eat at that immigration centre, that then goes on the bill to be paid back. So it's a really no-win situation for Yaman and his fellow clients.
It is. That's right. And they don't quite realise how bad it is until they get there. The pitch that's given to them sounds pretty hopeful. You know, come to Australia, work for us for a year, we'll secure you a visa and you'll become part of the community in Australia and you'll have a new home. But the reality of that is a little bit less hopeful than what they'd imagined. And they find themselves trapped in this facility, unable to escape.
Okay, well, give us the hope. You told us there's a love story at the centre of this book. Yaman used to be a housekeeper for the CEO, actually, of KB Yasuda, and the CEO's daughter, Rin. And she's our love interest. Can you introduce us to Rin?
So Rin Braden is a Japanese-American woman. Her mother, Alessandra Michaela Braden, adopted her from Japan when she was very young. And so she's been adopted into this life of privilege as the daughter of a very, very wealthy CEO. But it's not all roses for Rin Braden. She is expected to take on her mother's role at some point and take over the company from her mother and become the operator of KB Yasuda, which, as you can tell from what we've spoken about so far, excuse me, is a very unpleasant company to work for. And Rin can very clearly see how unpleasant it is. She describes their business model as building McDungeons. So it's a little hard for her to accept her fate, but nevertheless she feels a debt to her mother and she wants to she wants to do the right thing, I guess. So she does take on this role. She becomes a vice president in the company and she becomes responsible for negotiating with various governments around the world to try and build new facilities. And and in that role, she's required to do a little bit of corruption, a little bit of bribery, a little bit of leaning on people. And it leaves a very bad taste in her mouth. So when she falls in love with Yaman, he feels like an honest thing in her life, a real thing.
She's completely besotted with him, pretty much from the moment she sees him. But throughout the book, it struck me that he is far less trusting of her. And I wondered how much this wealth gap, this privilege gap, plays into this, that he is never quite sure what her intentions are.
Yes, I think it does. And as much as he wants to trust her and as much as he loves her, he just finds it incredible that someone in her position would love someone in his position. He finds it almost impossible to believe. And you can't blame him, really. I mean, from his point of view, who is he, really? He's just a housekeeper. Whereas from Rin's point of view, he's the first person in her life that's kind of taken her seriously and sees her for who she is and understands who she is. So they do form this bond. And you get the feeling for Rin that there is that Yaman is filling a hole in her life. There is something bigger there. There is some kind of real deep need that she feels. And Yaman fills that hole for her, and it becomes almost obsessional for her. Like, it's all consuming. It's the only thing in the world that she really truly desires. And she won't rest until she can have him back.
We were talking earlier about the big ideas that you're tackling in this book, Rowan. How hard is it to keep an eye and keep focused on this love story when there are so many other ideas that you're trying to pack in and talk to us about as readers?
Yeah, the structure of the novel is interesting. It took me a long time to figure out how to tell this story because it is quite complicated, and the plot moves fairly quickly and a lot of things happen. So it took me a little while to figure out the timeline, and the book is split into three timelines. We're mostly in the present. That's where most of the action takes place. But then we also hear a little from the past, and we also hear from the future as well. So figuring out how to bring in the information from all of these three time periods, plus two different points of view from our lovers, it took a little bit of working out. But I think the solution to it came mostly when I realized that I had two characters and that they were from different ends of the spectrum, really, different ends of the economic spectrum. Once I'd figured that out, it started to come together very quickly, and I could get a holistic view on this system, this quite cynical, greedy system that Yaman finds himself trapped in, and Rin as well. She's also trapped in it. They're both kind of victims of this one system. So that's where it sort of came from, I think.
Rowan, it's really easy to pigeonhole writers with certain genres, and previously we might have said that you were an historical fiction writer. This book, you've jumped into the future. How fun was it to take that leap?
Incredibly fun. Yeah, that was one of the things. You know, I grew up with Star Wars and I grew up with Star Trek, so I've always wanted to write about the future but do it in my own terms, I guess. You know, I'm a historical writer by training, so my approach to the future was as a historical writer. I used as much evidence as I could, and I tried to keep it as grounded as I could. I think science fiction is the big genre. Science fiction has to include books like Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, 1984 by George Orwell, as well as things like Star Trek and Star Wars. So it's a big genre, and it's so big that it's almost impossible to define. And I do think my book is science fiction and it fits in there, but it's also, calling it science fiction also doesn't quite tell you what's going on in the book. The science is in the background, the technology is kind of in the background. And I've foregrounded this relationship between the characters, and I've foregrounded the economics, and I've foregrounded the social reality of the future. So I don't know. I guess I'm writing sci-fi in a historical way. That's how I always thought about it. Yeah.
I think it's quite clever what you've done, because you haven't gone too far into the future, that everything seems plausible. The technology is just a slight step beyond the world that we understand now. I imagine that's a pretty hard line to tread.
It was, but also fun. The technology was the fun part, trying to figure out what are the next steps and look at what companies have in production or in pre-production now and imagining how it might exist 50 years from now. So in the book, everybody wears these glasses. Phones have kind of disappeared, but everyone wears a pair of glasses, and that lets them see virtual objects around them in the environment, kind of digital objects that you can pick up and manipulate. So it feels a little like magic, but we know from research, and we know from what the big companies are investing in now, that sort of technology isn't far away. And I guess the question is, does it replace phones and computers for us, or do we have all three of these different platforms going at once? To me, it felt a bit easier to get rid of everything else and just stick with the glasses. So I guess we'll see how that plays out.
The glasses seemed great. I really would like a pair. Also, just for simple things like, who is this person? What is their job? What is their marital status? I reckon it could be useful for all of us.
Wouldn't it just? Yeah. It would be incredibly valuable to have a pair.
Rowan Wilson, congratulations on this book, and it's been a pleasure speaking to you today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Claire.
Daughter of Bad Times is published by Allen & Unwin.